This is 69 the podcast. I'm Dave Haynes. 69 has been covering the digital signage industry for more than 11 years now, first online and now as a podcast. We cover what's new and interesting, and we filter out all the BS. This podcast gives listeners a chance to hear at length from people and companies who are making a real mark in the industry with new ideas or just old-fashioned hard work and smarts. You can listen to episodes online, get it from iTunes or Google Play, or use your favorite podcast app to pull down the RSS feed. We now have a companion podcast called Projects, hosted by my longtime industry friend Michael Tutton. That show is all about digging deep on the creative and tech behind some landmark projects. 69 is sponsored and supported by ScreenFeed, the digital signage content store. Burr Smith is the CEO of BroadSign, arguably the most successful CMS software company when it comes to advertising-based networks. His Montreal-based company has contracts with many of the top digital out-of-home ad networks in North America and Europe. Things are really good around BroadSign these days, but it hasn't always been like that. Smith not only runs the company, he owns it, and he steered it through a really rough patch in which the company ran into money troubles when the recession hit in 2008 and 9. That ultimately led to BroadSign filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. Smith talks candidly about that period and how he and a loyal core group scratched their way through and out of it. He also talks about where things are at now and why his company has broadened into a supply-side platform for programmatic advertising. Thank you for taking the time. I'm sure you're happy to have a seat for a few minutes at least.
Yeah, sure.
Thank God. So for people who don't know BroadSign, I would expect most would, but nonetheless, maybe explain what BroadSign is about. And I'm kind of curious about where it's come from and where it's going, because you're now, in many respects, becoming a media company.
I guess you could maybe say
yeah.
that.
Yeah, well, you explain it. You'll probably do a better job explaining it than me.
Well, I mean, so basically, BroadSign started out as a CMS company. It was a single product company.
Yeah, 2002, 2003, something like that.
Yeah, and actually before, long before me. And really has been that pretty much for most of its history. But when John and I came in 2014.
And John is?
John Beaudry.
Oh, John Beaudry,
CEO,
okay.
Yeah. We were looking at the business on the CMS side, and the conversion cycles are so long to get, you know, the major companies lined up. We started looking for other strategies, and one of the things that did happen when I got there is we were in the position where basically the money's in the room, so it's not like you have to go. To clear this and so mm-hmm. forth, and then you go back and you work on it some more. And so we were actually able to get to the point where, you know, I come into Montreal and we say, okay, we'll do this. We aren't going to do this. And this we may want to do, but we're not going to do it yet because it's mm-hmm. too early to do it and stuff like that. And so as we kind of view ourselves now, BroadSign really exists to be of service to our customers. And you can't, a company that's a service company can't make money without being of service to their customers and being partners with their customers. And so, actually, the way we kind of see ourselves now is in the Lumascape or whatever. There are clients that run this BroadSign CMS. There are clients that don't run the BroadSign CMS. There are people in the advertising agency. There are people in the digital area, and there's the agencies and so forth. And ultimately, where BroadSign wants to be is BroadSign wants to cover as much in that space in between those four corners of the box mm-hmm. as it makes sense for us to do. Now, there are clients or agencies or whoever will have their own secret sauce that they want to do, but at the end of the day, we want to fill in the places in that box
right.
that clients feel comfortable with us filling. Then the way BroadSign kind of does stuff is we've got a really, really, really bright group of people, and what we try and do is we try and look at a problem, if there's a problem in the industry, mm-hmm. and we try and figure out a way to focus on solving that problem. And we kind of like roll up our sleeves and look at it and then try and go at it until we see that problem solved.
So how, you know, you've been a media targeting scheduling delivery system primarily for place-based media. Right. How much of place-based or digital at home, whatever you want to call it, what's the percentage of the business that that represents? Is it like 90% of what you do?
Oh, it's I can't even tell you that because we have a number of big clients that use our software for things that are related to media and so forth, but we have clients that use it for other things. We had our customer advisory board in New York about 2 or 3 months ago, and one of the clients around the room, who's a very big client and a great company, he told me, we started talking about the new offerings that we're doing in the programmatic area and all of that stuff, and at the end of it he said, and you know, I understand what you're doing, Burr, and I appreciate what you're doing, but you know, that's not really the bulk of my business. A lot of my business is just doing other things, you know, so it could even be menu boards and stuff like that.
And so like a cinema company.
And so, and we have other customers that use our software for lots of reasons. So, I mean, you know, we know kind of what the breakdown of our biggest clients are and all of that stuff, but we really don't know their applications the way that we should. Now, one of the things that we did do when we kind of changed things is we're being much more proactive on trying to go out and visit our clients on a regular basis. So so we're out what we call waving products all the time and getting to know the clients and understanding what they're doing so that we can listen to them and say, what are the important things we need to be working on now?
Right.
And as we do that, we're a company that's in business. We can't provide, we're not the kind, everything we do has to be productized too. So as we list off those things and begin to get feedback back from the clients, the products we start to work on are the products that where the biggest group of people, where there's an identifiable market that we can figure out a way where we can play in that, because there's places where it's not the right place for us to play, or it's not the right place for us to play yet, and then we identify those things, and that's where we have a tendency to build. And at any point in time, so last year was really kind of an exciting time for us in January, because it was the first time. Pretty much, we built some small products before. It was the first time we actually launched major waves on brand new products that we considered to be new revenue streams. And at this juncture, given where we are revenue-wise, profit-wise, and cash flow-wise and all that stuff, we're in the place where we can probably handle about two, maybe three major products at a time. Mm-hmm. And we'll focus on those major products. We don't try and move around or anything like that. We focus on those major projects, build them out until we get them to the place where we figure it's a broad sign type product. And and as I think you know, and the quality of the product is the most important thing to us. And so we'll develop it until we get to the place where we can say, yeah, we're happy and comfortable putting Broad Sign's name on that. And then we'll maybe add on to the next product line.
So you can service a number of markets and verticals and so on, but really the core software and how you would be known in the marketplace is very much as company facilitating advertising delivery and so on.
At this juncture, that's probably
right. True. And the BroadSign SSP is supply.
Yeah.
Is that the right term for it?
Yeah, that's the right term for it. I'm not sure whether we've announced that yet, but yeah.
It's on your website.
Yeah, we haven't done that. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I found it on your website. Yeah, so can you explain what that is all about? Because effectively you're facilitating media buying for clients, right?
Yeah.
Or media selling.
So the concept on that is pretty simple. People identify us with advertising clients, and the advertising clients are looking for new revenue streams, and we're trying to figure out ways to access new revenue streams for them in a way that makes sense. So if you look at the market, you know, a lot of media companies are trying to build their own supply platforms and stuff like that. I'm at my core for the last 20 years or so, I'm an investor, right? And so I look at things based on, if you make an investment, you have to have a return on the investment. If you're investing in a particular industry and all of that stuff, it has to be an industry that's got the wind at its back. It's got to be a place where it makes sense that the market's going to develop. And I think I've said this to a lot of potential clients too. It doesn't make sense to me that the advertising money, the money in the programmatic space, is going to flow to an individualized platform. No. It's got to be a broad-based platform. Yeah. People are not, advertising agencies are not going to have at their trading desk 17 different websites or access points that they're going to plug into. It has to plug into the central core.
You're just creating more friction.
Right. And so to me, it seems very obvious, given the way that the market is right now, the most logical candidate to be able to bridge those supply sources together is broadside, mm-hmm. because we have a very broad client base, and we have a lot of screen count. Mm-hmm. And I use an example. I listened to Barry and some of the guys at the DPA talking about the DPA trying to build mm-hmm. together a network to sell programmatic space. If you were to add together a lot of the major networks in the DPAA, the fact of the matter is that Broadsign runs a screen count that is actually multiples of what the DPA can put together.
Yeah.
And so the idea of these individual networks trying to build their own solution or trying to connect together in some way, shape, or form to build that just doesn't make economic sense to me as an investor.
Right.
And so it made sense for us to go out and try and learn we have some talented people that understand the business, try and learn the way that the business works, and try and build a system that enables you to ease the friction of that system.
Right.
And so that's a project we spent probably 6 months to a year studying, mm-hmm. and then we started to build.
So, and in practical terms, what's happening? So if I'm a client running Broadsign software, and I have an out-of-home network in the Netherlands, because that's where we are, they can opt in on your supply-side platform and make some of their inventory available for media planners to look at and potentially buy.
That would be the plan.
Okay. And is it somewhat automated into the system, so you can set, if there's a threshold of 15% available, or do human decisions have to be made to decide as a network operator that I want to make
market,
stuff available?
As any market develops, you've got products, and there's a minimum viable product, and there's a product that's a deeper and more fulfilled product. I wouldn't say we're necessarily at the minimum viable product stage. We're probably a little beyond that, but I don't think we've really announced to the market yet all of the features that are in it. Mm-hmm. But the idea is, certainly, we built a lot of the infrastructure plumbing in there. Mm-hmm. There are going to be other things that will be built in future releases and so forth. And the idea is, again, always subject to what the needs of the individual clients are, because one client may want this and one client may want that.
Right.
But the idea that we're going to have is we're going to try and provide as much of that space as we possibly can and try and ease the friction as much as possible, because that's the way to make the dollars flow
right
into the system.
And if you're enabling that on the behalf of client networks, you make your money through the transaction process, like a Ticketmaster fee or something?
We'll have a small fee that, and it'll be, we're aware of what the economics is in the market, and we're obviously trying to mm-hmm. make it a very compelling proposition.
Mm-hmm. Are there any issues around that with your clients where they say, okay, this is not what we signed up for? Because it would strike me as, if I'm a member network, I'm probably pretty happy about it because this is making my life easier.
Every network, this is a...
Spit it out, Burr.
Well, it's not that I'm trying to be guarded or anything like that. I'm trying to think about how to respond to the question. Every client is unique. Uh-huh. Every client has their own way that they want to sell into the market. Every client has has their own vision. I mean, if you look at the concept of programmatic advertising, mm-hmm. everybody says programmatic advertising. And when we actually try to chart it out on a wall, we wind up with 6 or 7 different definitions of programmatic advertising. Well, that's no different on the client side, mm-hmm. right? So everybody has a different view to it. Everybody sees it as a potential opportunity, but everybody sees it as a potential threat too. So there are all sorts of different visions on how it's going to go. And I'm going to digress for a second, if I can, because I want to talk about the T-Rex thing for a second.
Ah, okay.
And I'm only going to do it as an example. It's not. Mm-hmm. So when that whole thing came up.
And just for people who don't know what that is.
It's a patent troll.
Patent troll.
So when that whole thing came up, and it wasn't in the context of T-Rex at the time, it was in the context of another troll that was out in the market 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Well, I remember the DPAA and a couple of the different federations all got together for a meeting to try and discuss what to do. And the problem with it is, you get all those people in the room, they all have different views on it, and they all have a different response to it.
Different agendas.
And at the end of the day, nobody can figure out what to do. So then what happens is everybody goes out, and then everybody settles or does something like that, which doesn't stop the problem at all.
It just
keeps it ongoing. So ultimately, then when we acted, and by the way, it's not like we're going to act for the industry every single time, but when we acted, the reason we acted was because it wasn't a place for, I mean, you can't get anything done if it's always submitted to a committee. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes what you have to do is you have to say, look, it, as I see it, this is the right thing to do. We have to do the right thing mm-hmm. to do. It may cost money, it may be a problem and all of that stuff, but somebody's got to do it, so you go out and you do it. And so everybody's been talking about programmatic, or this, or this, or this. Everybody proposes their own product.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, what you've got to do is you kind of sit down, analyze the problem, and come out with a solution. Mm-hmm. And you go out and you take the solution. And if it takes a risk, if there's a financial risk or something, you do that.
Yeah.
And you try and convince people this is the right way to go. And then what happens is people kind of say, I never thought of it that way. That makes sense. And then they either join you or they don't join you. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be probably what happens with us.
Right.
So I didn't want to rant on that thing, but the point is, you know, there's a time when you just have to, I mean, if you call it leadership, I mean, you have to just fix on what you're doing and you go that direction.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what's going to happen here. Mm-hmm.
So now I'm going to digress because I'm sure a lot of people are curious. When you said we just got to do this with T-Rex, what actually happened there?
Well, everybody kind of knows we filed the declaratory judgment action mm-hmm. in New York. The reason we filed, and I actually probably ought to be a little careful on this because it's litigation in process. We filed the declaratory judgment in New York, and that was because they'd filed all these suits, but nobody ever really knew what they were claiming, right? Mm-hmm. And everybody was always settling, and nobody ever, they never really got to the stage of discovery where anybody could say what they were trying to assert.
Right.
So we needed to file that in order to get some sort of an idea on what they were trying to assert. And then we filed 3 different contests of 3 different patents. And the, I think they were filed in a series of, in August and September of last year,
mm-hmm.
probably at 2-week intervals. And the responses have just been coming back recently.
So it's still going through the process, but
right.
you made the decision that we got to stop talking about this. Somebody has to go fight the troll.
And let me say, I can't always say that we're going to do stuff like that. You know, mm-hmm. at the end of the day, my biggest responsibility is the broadside
right.
community. And so at any point in time, I don't want to say that we're, you know, at the end of the day, I'm going to have to do what I have to do for BroadSign.
Right.
But I am not, I think that at the end, my judgment is that action was the right thing to do for the industry
right.
at the time.
How did you get involved with BroadSign? Because you're not only CEO, you're also majority owner, right?
Yeah.
So how did that all happen? Where did you come from?
I knew a guy that was in the original investor group.
Mm-hmm.
I was solicited to participate in a very small way, probably before 2007 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
In 2008, they came to us. I mean, you know kind of the story. The idea was they were going to do a roll-up and all of that stuff, and they were going to file public.
Conquer the world, yeah.
And so we did We did a bridge loan that was supposed to lead to another bridge loan that was supposed to lead the IPO. I talked to the subsequent financing sources. They all kind of they didn't guarantee, but they said they were going to do it. But that was 2008. Mm-hmm. And
recession starts.
Promises kind of disappeared around August and September of 2008. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of the year, the payroll wasn't going to be made. And it became a very long, involved process and so forth. But,
But at that point, you were still just a minority investor, or you...
At that point, there was nobody else that was putting money in.
Okay.
And I didn't do as good a job as I should have done on evaluating the management team. I didn't do as good a job as I should have done evaluating some of the partners that were involved. But we really did do a pretty good job on analyzing the product and analyzing the market. And
that's why you were the guy who did stick around.
At the end of the day, to use a kind of crass term, we had the ass to swing it. And we could do it.
So Broadsign kind of ran on fumes for a couple of years, maybe?
As you undoubtedly kind of well know, but yeah.
Yeah, well, for people listening, I was at Broadsign, and I left Q2. 2009, yeah. So I'd been there about almost 2 years or something like that.
So it was, there was a period of time where, for tactical reasons, it needed to be on life support. Mm-hmm. And because, if you got people that aren't particularly good people, you can't let them know there's an endless pot there. Mm-hmm. And when it's time to be serious, I can be serious.
Yeah.
And so we kept it as tight as it needed to be until we could be in the place where we could do what we needed to do with it.
Right. And what was the thing that, you're controlling things. You have your hand on the plug and the receptacle. You could have pulled the plug and pulled them off life support. What was the thing that made you decide, okay, I'm going to keep this thing going?
Well, I mean, there's so many things. It was a great product. It was a great product. The group of people at Broadsign, I'm kind of an old guy. I've been in business for a pretty long time. I have never in my life seen as talented a group of people in one collection as what I saw at Broadsign. And it's just it's kind of difficult. Mm-hmm. To run across that kind of a group of people at one time. And although a lot of my venture capital friends were telling me at the time, don't put your money here because it's an industry where money goes to die, I had been through the early days of the 90s and 2000s. And one of the things I really am pretty good at is kind of scenario planning for future markets and so forth. And I believe that there was going to be money that came to this market. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, what we found at the time that we emerged from the Chapter 11 proceeding was there were three things that happened. Number one, there are a lot of people that always wanted to be with the product, mm-hmm. but they were afraid of the financial circumstances of the product. And when we emerged from the Chapter 11, that was not a problem anymore. There was capital there. There was going to be capital there. And so that eliminated that. The other thing was, money started to come into the market. Mm-hmm. And so we exited that process haven't really looked back. So
there's a bunch of costs involved in putting this podcast together. So I'm very grateful for the support this podcast will get from our new and sole sponsor, ScreenFeed. Here's founder and CEO, Jeremy Gavin.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Gavin, CEO of ScreenFeed, the digital signage content store. As content people, we love great content, and we think Dave's doing a great job with this 69 podcast, which is why we've offered to sponsor it. If you'd like to see the content that we create on a daily basis, head over to screenfeed.com and check it out. Let us know if we can help you in any project you're working on. And do me a favor, if you don't find what you're looking for, shoot me an email at jeremy@screenfeed.com. I'm always interested in new ways we can help. Now back to the podcast.
And chapter 11 was something you did in 2011. And I assume that was a pretty hard choice.
In a way it was, but in a way it was simple. It was very clear that the company was in a situation where it could not, the existing status quo was not possible.
Right.
Something had to be done. And so basically we had to plan it out. We had to reach out to our clients because we needed to explain that to them.
Yeah.
And by the way, Brian Duchaud did a great job with that. And so we held a bankruptcy auction. I kind of, you know, a couple of the clients said, well, you're going to own the company at the end of the day. And I told them, well, I can't promise that because it's a bankruptcy auction, but I can tell you I've got a lot of money into the company and I've got a checkbook that I can write more if I need to. So anybody who wants to bid against me can bid, and they're going to have to bid a lot more than I can because I've got the debt too.
Yeah.
And ultimately what a lot of the customers said was they'll said, well, we'll stay with you if you win it, but if somebody else wins it, we'll leave. Mm-hmm. And so we bought the assets May 31st of 2011, and then we reverse engineered the re-merger and the exit from the Chapter 11 in October or something like 2011.
And at that point in 2011, were you an active day-to-day person within the company?
I'm not a passive kind of guy. I wasn't. Brian Duchaud was running the company on a day-to-day basis and so forth. But Brian and I were always talking 3-4 times a week. Mm-hmm. My wife used to say that I spent more time talking to Brian than I spent talking to her. And I was, you know, we were always actively involved. I don't think there was any major strategic decisions that I wasn't involved in. So I was involved. I just wasn't as involved as I am now.
Right. And when did you become full-time involved, like CEO?
February, March of 2014, I think.
Okay, so it's been a while now.
Yeah.
And that was because Brian left and did his own thing, and then he went to Civic, and he's off to, I forget what he's doing now, right? So where's the company at now? I mean, you went down to pretty small staff, but you've grown that back up.
I think we were, I don't remember exact counts. We were, I think 35 or something like that, and we're, I think, 82-ish, 83-ish. Oh,
okay. So you're quite a bit bigger than BroadSign once the recession hit and everything. It's like...
Yeah, our biggest problem right now is engineering talent.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's not... We're less short of market opportunities than we are of being able to get the people, great people. Because every time you hire, when you hire people, you never really know whether people are really good people and they match the company and all that for six months or so. But we try, and even at that, you know, your odds are out of rule of thumb, out of every 10 people you hire, there'll be one or two that are stars, there'll be one or two that you have to absolutely get rid of, and the rest of them will be people that you get as, you know, you try and get as much out of as you can.
Right.
BroadSign, by its very nature and its DNA, we want to skew that to the point where the stars actually maybe are even 50 or 60% of our so it's hard to get people of that quality.
Right.
But we try real hard to do that. Mm-hmm. And so the recruiting process of finding the right people is a challenge.
Is everything still hyped in Montreal?
Right now we got people in the bulk of the people are in Montreal. We've got salespeople. We've got several salespeople in North America that are headquartered.
Yeah, the usual stuff. They're scattered, but all the R&D and everything's in Montreal.
We've got salespeople in Europe. We've got some support people in Europe now. We've got a small office in New York to handle the programmatic side. Mm-hmm. And we've got some people in China to handle the Asian operations.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you guys pushed into System on Chip and Android a couple of years ago, or 2-3 years ago, and went pretty hard at it and marketed it, and in relative terms had quite a bit of success with it. But then you kind of push back out of it, right?
Right. We try to be a service to our clients. Mm-hmm. And at that point in time, our clients were concerned about the cost of Windows and Intel players. So the idea was to try and be able to provide a lower cost solution to our customers. Mm-hmm. And what we found was we did that for a couple of years. We actually prototyped a second unit. But at that point in time, what had happened was that the cost of other players had dropped down to the point where it no longer made sense for us to actually be in the business. And Android is a little bit of a difficult programming language to work with. Mm-hmm. And so at the end of the day, although we were looking at other languages, but it just didn't make sense for us to do that.
Right.
And the best thing for us to do is, as I said, our scarce resources are our engineering resources. It made more sense for us to deploy our engineering resources to things that were more meaningful to our customers than than to do a player.
Yeah. So. And you had, if you want to call it, activist suppliers like Intel who were actively interested in working with
Intel
you.
Intel made a change. Microsoft made a change. The economics changed entirely.
Yeah.
It made no sense for us to do that. It became a commodity business then.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't, and we were at a low price point when we were doing it, but that was simply to be a service to our customers.
Right.
And so there's no reason to do that when other people are going to be able to do it a lot better than we.
What's the installed base for you guys now that you can talk about?
I think we're, as far as screens, we're thinking 120,000, something like that.
And most of those are one-to-one?
No, obviously not. I know, you know, so we got Deco. And there's some places where there's
two-sided.
Tons and tons of screens being displayed. But then we've got some places where it's one-to-one.
So. But you have many tens of thousands of installed licenses.
We're right at 100,000.
Just
a little bit short.
Okay. I don't know if you can answer this, but you went through the financial straits. The company's now profitable?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's been profitable for, I mean, yeah.
You're happy.
No, it's just I'm not... I like to make money.
Yes,
I like to make money.
Investors are funny that way.
If it wasn't profitable by now, I would have figured out another thing.
Yeah, we were talking before we turned on the recording device about the industry as a whole, and we're at ISE here. There's so many companies and so many software companies and so on, and how do you look at that space when you see this hyper competition?
I think it's crazy, and it's going to happen. It's going to change. It's, you know, again, I don't like to offend people or say, I'm an investor, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, there are times in markets when markets get more mature. When the markets get more mature, the number of participants in the market decline.
Mm-hmm.
I think the number of market participants in this market has been accelerated because, following the 2008 crash, all of the central banks in the world went to an easy money policy, so it was easy to borrow money from everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the companies aren't borrowing money from the banks, but they're getting the money from venture capitalists who aren't getting any return, or venture capitalists or investors who aren't getting any return from anything else, so they're putting money into it. There is a point in time, and interest rates are starting to rise again, economically speaking. It's very clear at some point in time, people are going to want a higher return on their money. And when they want a higher return on their money, you're not going to be able to go out and raise money and lose it anymore. It just makes no sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're in a game of musical chairs. The music's going to stop. People are going to start taking away the chairs. And at the end of the day, there's only going to be so many chairs left.
Right.
And there's going to be players. And the players that are left are going to be players that make money.
Yeah.
You know, I don't mean to be offensive, but that's the way the world works.
Yeah. Well, it's happening in every other vertical. Yeah. Why wouldn't it happen here? For a long time, and I'm a pioneer with arrows in my back.
Yeah.
Having started a digital out-of-home network many, many years ago and not seeing the ad revenues I wanted to see, there's been a thought and an observation, and a fair observation for the most part, that digital out-of-home networks are very, very hard to sell. It's been there's a lot of roadkill out there. There's ones that have done very, very well, but many, many that have not. Are things changing?
Absolutely.
I heard somebody talking about that yesterday, that they see a lot more currency in PlaySpace because it's not nebulous like online
marketing.
It's the
closest place to the final buying decision. So even in the investment investment community, there's a flavor of the month.
Mm-hmm.
There's flavors of the month in technology. There's flavors of the month in investments. The flavor of the month, the flavor of the decade, for all intents and purposes, has been digital. There's problems with digital. Everybody knows that. Viewability, click fraud, things like that. That market is beginning to flatten out. If you looked at the public companies that are in that space, I mean, there are some that are dominant players that are still making money, but a lot of them are flattening out on the revenue side. And so even you're beginning to see some consolidation in that space now. When the money left that, it started going into mobile. I'm not sure that everybody has a clear economic understanding of what the value proposition in mobile is, but it was the flavor of the month. So it's been the flavor of the month for the last year or two or something like that, and that's going to continue for probably a little bit of a while.
Yeah.
But at the end, there's going to have to be an economic justification for how it works. It hasn't, I mean, it's begun to come, you know, when money started coming into the industry when we exited the Chapter 11 at 2011, some money, but not really the kind of money that I obviously started investing for.
Mm-hmm.
But that money will come. And it's all got to do about some of the stuff we talked about, eliminating the friction in the system and so forth. And when that comes, oddly enough, I'm going to say, we'll have a boom in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And historically speaking, and I've said this before, if you look at software, you know, whether you look at MS-DOS, whether you look at Microsoft Office and the Office suite, whether you look at Oracle's database, whether you look at whatever, historically speaking, what happens is there's a market with lots of players. Then all of a sudden the users begin to get the real value when you get standardized on one platform. And when that happens, you got a kind of a hockey stick growth in the industry. Now, then there is another competitor or two or something like that to keep those guys honest. But then there becomes a tremendous growth. There's a tremendous growth in efficiency. There's a tremendous growth in all of the things that make the market grow.
Right.
That'll happen until it gets to its irrational extreme, and at which point in time that will it'll begin to level off.
Right.
And we're not even at the beginning of that growth yet.
Right.
But it's, like I said, I've been around a long time. I can smell it, can feel it, and it's there.
So it's a little bit like, use example of something like CRMs. There were probably a whole bunch of CRM systems out there many years back, and it's whittled down, and now there's Salesforce.
Yeah.
And you want to be Salesforce.
We want to be of service to our clients.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have every expectation that BroadSign will be one of those two or three, and I frankly hope BroadSign is going to be number one.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there is a certain markets do the same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
And I see no reason to believe that this market is any different than any
all
of the other
ones,
markets we've ever seen before.
Yeah.
So that's, and obviously I've bet a lot of money on that,
You have a vested interest.
Yeah. So.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
That's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed listening and learned something. If you want to stay on top of what's happening and actually matters in digital signage, join thousands of readers who visit 16.9, that's 16-9.net, every day. If you like this podcast, please also check out the companion 16.9 podcast called Projects. That's done by Michael Tutton, and there's a new episode every second Friday. 16.9 the blog and now the podcast are properties of Vertical Media Consulting Group, the massive media empire I run out of a spare bedroom in my house near Toronto. Thanks to our podcast sponsor, ScreenFeed, and thank you for listening. I'm Dave Haynes.